It's November the 14th. We are in Parshas Vayechi in our creation class. And we're on page 282. We are in the middle of the bracha for Yosef. We went through it last time, but I wanted to go over a few more points before we move on. So we read through all of the psukim, all the verses, starting on the previous page from Pasuk Chav Beis verse 22 all the way through Chav Vav verse 26. And we discussed how Yosef became the one to sustain his family, even to sustain Yaakov himself, even though Yosef is the son, but he turned around and ended up being like a father figure for everybody, taking care of them when they were in Egypt. We talked about the various brachos, the various blessings that he got. We also discussed a little bit more in depth the first few psukim, the first few verses, about how Yosef was hated by his brothers, and that they were bitter towards him, and there was lashon hara that was spoken. We discussed that. Now I'd like to look again at Pasuk Chav Dalet verse 24. Now let's read those few psukim again on page 282, Pasuk Chav Dalet verse 24. I'd like to start from there with Yosef. So it says, "Vateshev be'esan kashto," which literally means, we'll read it along with the English, "but his bow was firmly emplaced, vayafozu ziroei yadav, and his arms were gilded, midei avir Yaakov, from the hand of the mighty power of Yaakov." The mighty power of Yaakov is, of course, Hashem. "Misham ro'eh Evan Yisrael, from there he shepherded the stone of Israel." So the simple meaning of this pasuk, this verse, is that it's talking about the strength of Yosef, the blessing that his arms were gilded, which means that they were covered and glittered with beauty, with riches, and the mighty power of Yaakov is, of course, Hashem. And then from there, Yosef went on to shepherd the Jewish people. We mentioned that the words "vayafozu ziroei yadav," that is, his arms were gilded. One way of understanding it is that's the placement of the signet ring that Paro had, and placing it on Yosef's finger, that was giving him strength and power. Let's read a little further. "Mekel avicha v'yazareka," this was from the God of your father, and he will help you. "Ve'ish shakai v'yvarecheka," and with, again, another word for Hashem, and he will bless you. "Birchos shamayim mi'ol," the blessings of the heaven above. "Birchos tahom rovetzes tachas," the blessings of the deep crouching below, the deep water crouching below. "Birchos shadayim varacham," which they translate as blessings of being able to nurse, and also blessings of having children. As I mentioned to you last time, the word shadayim could refer to blessings that to feed a child, to nurse a child. It could also be referring to the blessings of a man being able to have children. And so if you read it that way, it would go together, the blessings of both the men being able to have children and the women being able to bear children. Birchos, next pasuk, "Birchos avicha," the blessings of your father, "gavrua birchos harai," surpass the blessings of my parents, "ad ta'avas givos alam," until the endless boundaries of the world's hills. "Tiyana l'rosh Yosef," they would go to the head of Yosef, "ulekadkod nzirachav," and the head of the exile of his brothers. So the last two psukim, Chafhei and Chavav, 25 and 26, talking about the blessings that Yosef got. The Yosef got all these wonderful blessings of bounty in his land, of children, of the blessings were even greater than the blessings of Yaakov's fathers, of Avram and Yitzchak, but they just kept on going. Now there is another angle to this whole discussion of Yosef, and it refers to what is certainly the most pivotal moment in Yosef's young years, and that was when he resisted the attempts of Potiphar's wife to seduce him. And when he did so, we know that that landed him in jail. He ran away, leaving his clothing with her, and he ended up in jail. And then from there, things started to get better. He was able to interpret the butler's and the baker's dream, and then interpret Paro's dream, and he became the viceroy of Egypt. That resistance earned Yosef the title Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous. Until then, he was plain Yosef. Now he's known as Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous. And that resistance was nearly superhuman. It was an incredible resistance. But we talked about it when we learned it in Parshas Vayeshev, but let's remind ourselves of just how difficult it was for him to resist. Remember that he was a slave, and a slave in Egypt had fewer rights than a slave in America before the Civil War. A slave in Egypt, anything could happen to that slave. The master had the right not just to beat the slave or torture the slave, but to kill the slave. There were no rights for a slave. A slave was nothing, a piece of property. The Yosef certainly had no rights. Yosef was being seduced by his master's wife. She had as much power over him as his master did. She could do with him as she pleased, and he was at her whim. The only thing that prevented her from getting her way until that point in time was the anger of her husband that would have prevented her, and also the fact that others would report what she did with Yosef. Yosef had to make sure to be around other people. When she finally caught him, that was when the house was empty, as the Torah tells us in Parshas Vayeshev. Everybody else had gone because it was a religious holiday and they had all gone away. She feigned being sick and stayed home. And when Yosef came to the house to do his work, so then she knew that she had him. When he ran away, he risked being executed for it, because here his master's wife claimed that he had attacked her instead of her trying to get him. So Yosef was certainly in a very compromising position, and it was very difficult to resist her. In addition, the Medrash tells us that she worked on him for weeks and weeks and months, where she would, the Medrash says, she would wear different clothing in the morning and in the evening. Every time she saw him, she would make sure to dress differently. She would make sure to make herself look appealing every time she knew that she would be near him. So that it was a constant battle where this woman was always after him. Had he given in, he would have gotten away with it. She wasn't going to let her husband find out about it. And she was interested in an ongoing relationship with Yosef. So Yosef here had someone who was after him regularly. He had no power to stop her. He had no power to go somewhere else. He couldn't say, you know what, I don't want to work in this house anymore. I'd like to go someplace else to not be in this environment. We know that today, if a person, man or woman, is in a work environment where they are faced with such a challenge, that we know that there are, first of all, there's rights that a person has, that a person could theoretically take an employer to court or complain. And even if they don't want to do that, they could quit and find another job if they must. If they absolutely can't stay in that work environment, they could find another work environment. Yosef had no choice. He couldn't not work there anymore. He couldn't say, you know what, I'd rather plow the fields instead of polish the silver. He had no choice. He did what he was told to do. And so he was really in a very difficult position, and she was constantly trying to get his attention. And he resisted and resisted and resisted and resisted and resisted. And finally, at that last moment where she actually grabbed hold of him and there was nothing he could do to stop her, the only thing he could do was run away, that was the final challenge to Yosef. And he nearly gave in, but he ran off. And when he ran off, he left his clothing with her because she had grabbed it, and knew that he was now at her mercy, because she would and did claim that it was the other way around, that he had attacked her. He would have been executed had it not been for the fact that his master, her husband, had suspicions that she was making up a story. And so he did not execute Yosef, but he did throw him in jail. He had to throw him in jail. Yosef, the Gemara tells us, is mechayev es harishayim. Yosef is the one who obligates those who give in to their desires. Which means as follows. The Gemara tells us various people who obligate us, obligate others. For instance, the Gemara tells us Hillel, the famous Hillel, you know the story of the famous Hillel, who wanted to hear the words of Torah, but he couldn't pay the fee, the daily fee that there was to get into the Beis Medrash, to get into the study hall. It was a pittance, but he couldn't afford it. He's extremely poor. And in order to hear the words of Torah, he climbed up on the roof and listened from the skylight on the roof. It was very cold that day. There was snow. And he ended up being frozen up on the roof and covered in snow. They discovered him. They sought him out and saved his life. It was a Shabbos, and they lit a fire in order to save his life, as you know that it's permitted to do that, in order to save somebody's life. And from there he went on to become the great Hillel. The Gemara tells us Hillel is mechayev es aniyim. Hillel obligates the poor. If a person comes after 120 years, goes up to heaven, and they say to him, "Why didn't you study Torah?" And he says, "I didn't study Torah because I was too poor. I couldn't afford to study Torah. All I could do all day was try to find work and try to find money to support my family." They will say to him upstairs, "Are you any more poor than Hillel? Hillel was more poor than you are. And yet, Hillel found a way to study Torah." Hillel obligates those who are poor. The Gemara tells us about another sage who is mechayev es ha'ashirim. There's another sage who obligates those who are rich, because he had tremendous assets, and as everybody knows, when a person is very wealthy, has a lot of assets, the wealth keeps him busy. He's got to watch, take care of all his different assets, all different business dealings, and otherwise the whole empire collapses. He's got to stay on top of it, otherwise the fortune disappears. So there was a great sage who was willing to forego his fortune because he said, "I have to study Torah. I can't be constantly focused on my wealth. I have to take care of studying Torah." Person after 120 years goes up to Shamayim and says, "I didn't study Torah because I was too wealthy. I was too busy with all of my assets." They say to him, "Are you any wealthier than this sage?" It's Rabbi Elazar ben, I can't remember, it's one of the Rabbi Elazars. There are a few Rabbi Elazars. So they'll say, "Are you any wealthier than he was? He was wealthier than you, and yet he found a way to study Torah." Yosef is Mechayev es HaRishayim. Yosef obligates those who are evil. Now, evil here doesn't mean like evil, like sadistic. Evil means a person who gives into their taiva, gives into their desires. Person says, "I couldn't help it. I had such a strong desire. What do you want me to do, Hashem? What do you want me to do? I couldn't. I was supposed to study Torah, but I was too busy. I had so many desires. I just couldn't keep my mind on my studies. My mind would wander to all of my various interests and my various desires, and I just couldn't do it." Hashem will say to the person, "Do you have any more desire than Yosef did?" Yosef had a far greater challenge of desire than you did, and yet Yosef found a way to resist. And so Yosef is mechayev es harishayim. He obligates those who gave in to their inclinations. Now, that Gemara that says that these three obligate the poor, the rich, the desirous, they're all obligated because of these three people. We have to understand what that means. There was a book that was printed when I was still a bachur in yeshiva, and the book challenged this Gemara by asking, "What do you mean? Why do we need these three examples? Hillel, Rabbi Elazar, Yosef, to obligate these the poor person, the rich person, the desirous person. The Torah obligates us. Why do we need an example? If the Torah says that you're not allowed to commit adultery. So what do you need an example of Yosef for to say you can't commit adultery? The Torah says you can't commit adultery. If the Torah says you must study Torah, so why do we need the Hillel as the example that you have to study Torah? I mean, of course you have to, a man has to study Torah. What's the question? Why do you need the examples? So the author of this book, who remained anonymous, he did not print his name in the book, he writes, and it resonates as being the truth when he writes, that you wouldn't need an example. Let's say that a person after 120 years goes upstairs and they say, why were you a pickpocket? So he says, well, I wanted people's money, so I was a pickpocket. They're not going to have to say, Pransky wasn't a pickpocket, so why were you a pickpocket? they're not going to have to do that, because the Torah says don't steal. I mean, they don't have to bring examples, of course. Well, he's obligated because he's a pickpocket, and the Torah says don't steal. We all know that. If a person kidnaps somebody, God forbid, they're not going to bring examples. he's a terrible person, he kidnapped. Murderer. Well, you don't have to bring examples. But over here, what the Gemara is doing is saying that there are certain situations where a person is pushed so far to the limit where a person might be tempted to say, I know it's wrong, but I have an excuse. I'm in such dire straits. Hashem, you can't blame me anymore. What do you want me to do? I'm so desperately poor. I can't feed my family. I can't. What do you want me to do? It's okay for me not to study Torah. It's okay for me to steal a little bit. How do you expect me to survive? A person can be pushed to the point where they feel that they have an excuse. Now, sometimes there is an excuse. Sometimes there is. A person is, God forbid, a person is being held in captivity by people who are ruthless people who are going to hurt the person. So, and the only way to get out of that of captivity is to kill his captors or to steal from his captors. I mean, that's of course okay. There are situations where a person is pushed to the limit and it is permitted to do things wrong. Or, like we just mentioned, a person is at Shabbos and there's a life and death situation. A person is supposed to violate Shabbos in order to save a person's life. So there are situations where a person is pushed to the limit and it's appropriate to cross the line because that's what the Torah says to do. But there are times where a person is pushed almost to the limit, but it's not quite there. He's at the verge, but could still make it. And we give up. We say, well, you know, can't handle it anymore. It's too much. But it's not too much. Really, we could go a little further. That's where these people are going to obligate us. That's where Hashem is going to say, look, Hillel had it worse than you, and he managed. Rabbi Elazar had it worse than you, and he managed. Yosef had it worse than you, and he managed. That's where this Gemara comes in. It's not talking about regular cases. Regular case where I'm just sitting around and I'm talking I'm talking to my wife and I tell her a juicy piece of Lashon Hara. Then there's no need for the Hashem to say, well, Chafetz Chaim didn't speak Lashon Hara, why did you speak Lashon Hara? The Torah says, don't speak Lashon Hara. It's only when I'm pushed to the limit, where I'm on the verge, I'm saying like, the desire is so strong to save the Lashon Hara, and I can't resist anymore. That's when Hashem says, well, 1 second, you know the Chafetz Chaim resisted, how come you didn't resist? That's where the example is pulled out. That's when Hashem whips it out. Where the example is for when a person's on the edge. Yosef was on the edge. He was on the verge of giving in. And he was at a point where a person might have rationalized and said, it's too much. It's just too much. How much can a person take already? And at that point, he could have given in. And he was a tremendous struggle not to. And he overcame his inclination and ran out the door. That's what he was able to do. That's why Yosef is the example of the person who is on the verge of giving in to their desires, but doesn't do it. And he's the one who obligates those who do give in. And we all, unfortunately, give in at a certain point. We've given in at a certain point. The Yosef is our example to tell us not to. To have that final resolve, that final last ounce of strength and say, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to speak the Lashon Hara. I'm not going to cross that line and run out the door and not do it. That Yosef is the one who is that example. I'm telling you all this because I want to show you something in the verses that's very, very interesting. You have a question?
Yes, I'm going to deviate a little from the Torah, but you mentioned something.
Never deviate from the Torah.
Yeah, well, no.
Okay.
But you're talking about studying the Torah. And right now, in Israel, they are claiming financial major problems for the population is increasing, and the economy can't bear it. I'd like to hear something from you.
About when a person should study Torah. Studying the Torah doesn't mean that a person shouldn't work for a living. But a person can't say that I have no time at all to study. That's what that comes. I think whatever there is not talking about a person studying and not working. Hillel worked. Hillel was a wood chopper. But that day there was no wood there was either no wood to chop or there was no buyers for the wood. What he did is he would work half the day and he would study half the day.
But the article insinuated that the majority of them just studied and even afterwards graduating that they continued to study and didn't work.
And that I'm not going to comment on, not now anyway. We can talk about that privately. But that's not what this Gemara is referring to. This Gemara is referring to just saying, well, I can't study Torah at all because I'm too busy.
No. Are we studying Torah? Is this considered?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Sure.
I don't know if we're just skimming or...
No, we're studying. Studying. Studying Torah.
Sorry, I brought it up.
No, that's good. It's fun.
No, I'm late.
Yes.
Two things. One is when you said that Hillel was a wood chopper, you would regularly think of someone that studied Torah as, you know, not very muscular, but to be able to chop wood, you really build up. Was that his trait?
Well, he was.
Like
that,
see, like the American wood chopper. See him in jeans, and strong muscles,
You don't know Hillel wore jeans.
Like I was
Well, remember this is a young Hillel we're talking about over here. We're not talking about the age, the old Hillel with the long white beard. Not up to this is before he became the leader of the Jewish people.
So this is about a young.
I mean, he had a family. He had a family, but
you chop wood. You need.
All right.
How much wood can a wood chop?
I've had.
This man must have been a Taurus.
I've had some rebbeim in my life that I was very happy when I acted up in their class that it was no longer PC to have corporal punishment in class.
Right.
They were quite powerful individuals.
the other thing I wanted to mention is that I had heard that the Potiphar's husband was really, I mean, he was a husband by name, but he really wasn't like a husband, you know, where they had intimacy. There was a problem with him.
So
he must have been very...
That could be.
Not all for him.
He certainly was. She certainly was. And but that doesn't justify it.
No, absolutely not.
Right.
That would be...
Yeah, it just adds to that. Right, right.
Right.
Now, here's what happened. When Yosef was at that last moment, and he was ready to give in, at the last moment, he resisted and ran out. That's what he did. Now, when he ran out, though... He was on the verge of having given in. So in order to blunt that desire, to stop that desire, he ran outside, and the Medrash says, and he took his fingers and he dug them into the ground, which scraped. He took his, imagine like gravelly ground, and he just dug his fingers into the ground, which cut his fingers up, which caused immense pain. And pain, as you know, is something which will blunt desire. Pain blunts desire. If a person has a very strong emotion, and then there's another emotion that is equally stronger, greater, it can blunt the other one. The famous example that many of the Musar books say is the man who is running across, he's got this tremendous desire for whatever sin it is, doesn't make a difference, you can fill in the blank with whatever you want, and he's running across the frozen river to, it's the middle of the winter, the river is frozen solid, and he, on the other side of the river is the sin that he wants to get to, and he's running across the river to get to that sin, and then all of a sudden he hears a crack. All of a sudden the desire is gone and he's headed back the other way. So what happened to the desire? Because the desire was powerful, but the fear was a stronger emotion which superseded his desire, and it knocked the desire right out. That's what Yosef did. He understood that if he was going to defeat this inclination, he needed a more powerful emotion that would drive out the emotion of desire. And so he inflicted pain upon himself by digging his fingers into, and we're not talking about soft sand, we're talking like a gravelly, like imagine like a finger's going right in, the skin being scraped and cut, and that's what he did. And that caused the desire to stop. So this is what is one of the meanings of the words Vayafozu Zeroei Yadav, which the English here is, his arms were gilded. So the other way to explain it is, his arms, which means in this case his fingers, were scraped, were, I don't know if you want to use the word skinned, but literally cut up as he drove them into the ground. That's another meaning of this verse. Now what happened for Yosef, one of the Midrashim says, how did Yosef get that last resolve, that last ounce of strength to resist the wife of Potiphar? When he was on that mountain, what happened?
He saw his father's face.
Now many ask, well, one second, I mean, so that's not fair. You know, if I would see Yaakov's face right before I was about to sin, I wouldn't sin either, right? Mm-hmm. If I would see even my own father's face, I'd be too embarrassed.
That's what I was thinking of.
But
my father, right. I was more afraid of him than God.
Right. Well, that's, you know, but the thing is, this wasn't some sort of intervention by Hashem. This was because Yosef had been thinking of his father the whole time that he was away. This was Yosef who had been thinking about how he belongs. Remember we talked about how Yosef, even when he was in Egypt and he was by himself, he still connected himself with his father back in Israel. And then he's constantly thinking along those lines. So it wasn't like a foreign thought for him. This was something he thought about all the time. That's what kept him strong and kept him as a God-fearing Jew, even when he was in the hedonistic Egyptian society. At that moment, that flash of seeing his father's face, it was just conjuring up what he had always seen throughout his stay in Egypt. It was his own doing that now his father's face appeared to him. The Medrash says further that he had an exchange with his father. He actually talked with his father. Now, it doesn't mean he actually talked to his father, but in his mind, this is what was going through. His father was saying to Yosef, Yosef, you know that in the future, all of your brothers are going to have their name written on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. Would you like your name erased from everybody else's name? Would you like your name not to appear there? And with that, Yosef ran out. Now, what does that mean? Yosef conjured up in his mind, he managed to think about the future. Usually when we have a desire, all we can think about is the here and now. I gotta have it. And what are the consequences? What's gonna be down the line? Can't even think about that. That's out the window. Yosef managed to think about the future, to think about how for this fleeting act, which will give him a certain degree of satisfaction now, but it will destroy him for the future. It will erase him from his place amongst the Jewish people. And so he ran out. He managed to conjure that up. That's the other meaning of this verse. Midei Avir Yaakov, from the mighty power of Yaakov, meaning from having seen Yaakov's face. Mishamro Evin Yisrael, from there he went to be the shepherd of the Jewish people, because he was able to run out. Now, what happens to Yosef because of this?
Can I put out something very interesting?
Yeah.
I don't know if you meant this, but where it says, Misham Roeh Evin Yisrael, he became a shepherd because of the stones on the breastplate that he saw.
Correct.
That's what you meant, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay. So what do you mean he became a shepherd?
He became a great person.
Right. That's correct. That's correct. Now, then it says, what happens because of Yosef? So let's read again. I'm reading now Chafei 25. May Kel of Yichav Yazreka, this came from the God of your father and he should help you. Beis Shakai Bivarachaka and Hashem and he should bless you. Birchos Shamayim may all, you get the blessings of the heavens above. Birchos Tahom Ravetas Tachas, you get the blessings of the deep below. So you get incredible blessing. Birchos Shadayim Varacham. Blessings are essentially of childbearing. Of either this means of women being able to feed their children, to nurse their babies, and to have children, or it means the men and women both being able to have children. We don't find this blessing by the other tribes, specifically a blessing to have children, about having children. Yosef gets this blessing. Why does he get this blessing? And the reason why Yosef gets this blessing is because the area that he resisted was in the same act that involves procreation. Yosef resisted abusing that act. And because Yosef resisted abusing that particular act, the blessing he got was in kind, that he and his descendants would have the blessing of having children with relative ease. It doesn't mean that Yosef was exempt from all the troubles of childbirth that we know that exist, but he would have relative ease, that he and his descendants, that they would have the ability to procreate relatively easily. We'll get to questions in a moment. And along the same lines, the verse continues in Chavav 26, Birchos avicha gavrua birchos harai, the blessings of your father are greater than the blessings of my parents, my antecedents. Ad ta'avas givos olam. Now, the word ta'avas is translated two ways. Here, they translate it as the endless bounds of the world's hills. Ta'avas, a ta'ava can be a boundary. Until the endless boundaries of the world's hills, that's how much you get. The boundaries. But the word ta'ava, besides meaning boundary, also means?
Desire.
The word ta'ava also means desire. You, Yosef, are blessed with all the desires of the world. You'll get all the desires of the world. All the wealth, all the bounty, everything. Everything that people desire, you will get. Why does he get that? Because he resisted desire. He was able to resist his desire, so he gets the blessing of having that which people desire. He gets it. Why is that? I mean, isn't it counterproductive here? You have a man who managed to resist all his desire. So Hashem should say, okay, this is a person who I'm not going to tempt anymore. He managed to resist, so he deserves not being tempted. I mean, if anything, isn't that what we want? Don't we want not to be tempted by sin? Wouldn't that be the greatest thing? Any sin, pick whichever sin is the one that really gets us. Every single one of us has something that gets us, whatever it is. We all know what our personal problem is, our personal issue is, and we all have it, whether it's lashon hara, whether it's food, whether it's anger, whatever it is, but we all have something that we just have a lot of trouble controlling. Wouldn't we love it if we didn't have any temptation? Wouldn't that be great?
I forget where in the Torah it says, Hisabu Tama,
desire to have a desire. That's true. It says it in Precious Bahalakot. So, but wouldn't we, if you're thinking straight, wouldn't you want to get rid of your desire or at least not be tempted by it? But what Hashem is saying is this. The person who has demonstrated that they know how to control and use their desires properly, they're the ones who are able to have access to those very same desires. Hashem only wants a person to use this world properly. We're not expected to go through this world without using what the world is here to offer. We're expected to benefit from this world, to enjoy the world. But Hashem wants us to use it and benefit from it properly and enjoy it properly. A person who demonstrates that they are able to use and benefit from the world properly, which means to resist it when he's supposed to resist it and only indulge when he's supposed to indulge, that person gets the blessing of having access to the desires, because he's a person who has shown that he's able to do it properly. Yosef, who has demonstrated his ability to control his desire when it should not be used, he's given access to desires because he can use it properly. Yeah.
So that's how it connects to a boundary?
Well, you're right. You mean you have both words. But the same word can mean desire and boundary, right? If you very good, excellent. I didn't think of that. Excellent. That a person who is able to have boundaries is able to have the desires. It's no trick. It's no trick to give in to one's desires. It's tricky to say no. If we are able to say no, then Hashem gives us the ability to say yes. If we're able to say that I call the shots, we're able to tell our Yetzer Hara, our evil inclination, you don't tell me when and how to indulge. I'll decide when and how to indulge. Then Hashem says, fine. If you can demonstrate that, then you have the right to indulge. And Hashem does that. A simple exercise. Try this. A simple, simple exercise. Try this once, twice. Try it a few times. Pick a food that you really like. I'm assuming that most of us in this room, there is a food that we really like. Most everybody has a food that they really like, whether it's chocolate, whether it's candy, or it's something healthy, it's something that we like, whether it's a good steak or a good burger or a
check.
A grilled salmon, ice cream, whatever it is. Pick a food that we really like. The next time that we are able to indulge in that food, and we're able to do it, let's say, today's Sunday, let's say it's tomorrow. Tomorrow's Monday. Let's say, you know what? It's Monday. Monday, we're allowed to indulge if we'd like, but it's not a mitzvah. There's no mitzvah to have ice cream on a Monday. There's no mitzvah to have chocolate on a Monday. But on Shabbos, it's a mitzvah to indulge. Hashem says, you're supposed to have oneg Shabbos. You're supposed to indulge on Shabbos. Shabbos is a day for indulging. That's what Hashem says. So try it. Try saying, you know what? It's only Monday. Monday's not a time for ice cream. I'm going to save the ice cream for Shabbos. Now, I can't go to the store and buy it on Shabbos, but I can buy it before Shabbos, put it in the freezer, and then on Shabbos, of course, not after having a meat meal, but but we can indulge in the ice cream or the cake or the candy or whatever it is, and put it aside and say, look, today's not a day for indulging. It's not wrong. It's not a sin to indulge. It's not a sin to indulge on Monday, but it's not a mitzvah. But it is a mitzvah to indulge on Shabbos.
How much is indulging?
Come on. How can you have just a little bit?
According to that, those who indulge, bulge. I read that
enough. You read that?
Okay. What did she say? Those who indulge, bulge.
I'll think about it.
I didn't
hear it. Can
I go back to, I didn't understand this part. It says, he shepherds the stone of Israel. Can you explain that one more time to me?
He became the shepherd of the Jewish people. He took care of all the Jewish people. We said that the word stone is a contraction, we said this last time, of Av and Ben, father and son. He became the one that shepherded, that took care of both Yaakov and his siblings.
And that's what that means.
Yeah. So there's an example. It's a relatively benign way of training ourselves to say no and be in control and telling our inclination, we call the shots. We'll have the candy on Shabbos, because I want to do it when it's a mitzvah. I don't want to do it on a Thursday. I want to do it on a Shabbos. That's a way where we call the shots, where we tell our inclination, you're not in control, I'm in control. So that is Yosef. The last tribe, the last Shevet, gets one verse, one pasuk, and that is Pasuk Chav Zayin, verse 27, that's Binyamin. Binyamin Ze'ev Yitraf. Binyamin is a predatory wolf. I love that. A predatory wolf. Baboker Yochal Ad. In the morning he will devour prey. Uvila erev yechalek shalal, and in the evening he will distribute spoils. Now, that verse, more than any of the other ones, makes Binyamin seem very fierce. None of the other ones had that fierceness. The only one that is even comparable is Dun. He'll be Dun will be a snake on the road, a serpent on the path, who bites the foot of the horse. But even there, it's not as descriptive as this. And even if you want to say it is as descriptive as this, Dun has three verses. That's only one. There are two other verses in there. Dun will judge his nation for your salvation. I hope to Hashem. You know, there's more to Dun than just the analogy to the snake. But Binyamin, this is just, I mean, I'm picturing like, you know, sharp teeth coming out of his mouth, you know, this look of, you know, intense fierceness in his eyes. Binyamin is a predatory wolf. In the morning he'll devour his prey, in the evening he will distribute the spoils. that's what it reminds me of. So what is this? But Binyamin, I mean, he was the youngest of the tribes, and we don't find any kind of fierceness in him. Certainly no description of that in the Chumash. Later on in the Navi and the prophets, we find a little bit more about the tribe of Binyamin, but in the Chumash we don't find anything like this. So the word Yitruf, which they translated here as to be predatory, the word Yitruf actually literally means to snatch, to grab, to swipe, to snatch. That's the best word, to snatch. He's a wolf that snatches, a snatching wolf. In the morning, he'll eat his prey, devour his prey, and in the evening he'll divide the spoils. The Gemara tells us, and Rashi brings some of it over here, that Binyamin has the distinction of having produced the first king, Shaul, Saul, comes from Binyamin. Even though we know the line of royalty comes from Yehuda, from David, from King David, but that's only once David became king. Prior to David HaMelech, he was permitted to have a different king. It came from a different tribe, and that, in this case, was Binyamin, was from Binyamin, was Shaul, was Saul. And he was the first king. And that's what it means in the morning, meaning in the early part of Jewish royalty, the morning meaning the very beginning, at its fledgling stages, he will devour prey. Yet Shaul, Saul, was very successful in all of his wars and brought security to the Jewish people by defeating the enemies around them. And in the evening refers to after the sun has set on Jewish royalty, which is at a time of exile, of galus. Even then, Binyamin is still doing his work. And that comes true in the story of Purim and Mordechai and Esther, who come from Binyamin. They are from Binyamin, and they're the ones who defeat Haman. That happens during exile, when there no longer is a Jewish king, and there they will distribute the spoils. They're still going to be victorious, even in the evening after the sun has set. Binyamin is compared to a wolf, a snatching wolf. What does it mean to snatch something? So to snatch something is to grab it away, right? So what do you need to snatch something? What are some qualities a person needs? We're all sitting around and there's something here, or better yet, there's a powerful man sitting here guarding this object, and I need to snatch it and run off with it. You got to be real quick.
Agility.
You need agility.
Good eye.
You got to be very, very observant, right? Keenly aware of what's going on.
Brave.
Brave. And above all, you need to be quick. Get very, very quick. The Gemara tells us that Shaul, Saul, before he became king, already distinguished himself as being a mighty warrior, and he had a run-in with a famous man named Goliath. Before the story of David and Goliath, of David and Goliath, there was the story of Shaul and Goliath, Saul and Goliath, less known, but equally true. What happened with Shaul and Goliath? What happened is that earlier in history, it goes back several years before Shaul was to become king. At that time, the Jewish people made a mistake, and they were battling the Plishtim, battling the Philistines, and they made the mistake of sending into battle. They lost the war with the Philistines, with the Plishtim. And they decided that in order to win the next war, they would need to bring out a special weapon. And so they took the Aron, the holy ark, with the tablets inside, and took it out to battle with them as a special tool to defeat their enemies. This was not supposed to be done. The Jewish people had two arks. They had two arons, two of them. One housed the tablets, but remember there were two sets of tablets. There was the second set, which were unbroken, which were complete. There was the first set. The first set were broken. There was a second ark that held the broken tablets, the ones that Moshe had smashed when he first came down the mountain and the Jews were worshipping the golden calf. That was kept in a separate ark. In the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the Holy of Holies, in the inner sanctuary of the temple, that's where the ark that held the second set of luchos, the second set of tablets, the whole ones, W-H-O-L-E, were being kept. That was where it was. There was a second ark that had the broken tablets in it. When the Jews went to war, they would regularly take the ark with the broken tablets. That was not unusual. But this time, they took the ark from within the sanctuary, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, that had the second tablets in it. They should not have done that. And they did. And they went out to war with it. Hashem punished them for this. And for the only time in history, the enemies, the Philistines, got their hands on the ark. They beat the Jews in battle and got the ark. Now, it ended up being a terrible thing for the Plishtim, because when they got the ark, after the battle was over, they took the ark back and they put it in with their Avodah Zarah, with their idol. And in the morning they came back and their idol had fallen flat on its face and was smashed. And this happened several times. Plus, the city in which the Aron was kept, was that they kept it in, all the people of the city became afflicted with terrible sicknesses as a punishment for them taking the Aron, to the point where they got rid of it. They realized that this was supernatural, and they realized that they should not hold on to this thing. It's not for them. And they sent it back to the Jewish people. It's very miraculous how it went back to the Jewish people, a whole story in and of itself, which is told in Sefer Shmuel in the book of Samuel. When the Plishtim grabbed the ark, they didn't just grab the ark. They grabbed the ark, they opened it up right away, and took out the tablets. Who was the one, the Plishti, the Philistine, who would be so bold and have such chutzpah to open up the ark and take out the tablets?
Goliath.
That was Goliath. A little bit younger than he would be later when he had the battle with David, but nevertheless, it was Goliath. And he took the tablets out of the ark. The Jews were losing the war. They were to lose this war. Jews were being killed right and left. But as Goliath triumphantly took out the tablets, he held them for maybe a second or two, and they were gone. Because Saul, who was there in the battle, ran up, snatched the tablets right out of Goliath's hands, and bolted back to Israel with the tablets and got away. He was a Ze'ev Yitruf. He was a snatching wolf. As Goliath had those tablets in his defiled hands, in his impure hands, Saul saw that, realized that that can't be allowed to happen, snatched them out of his hands. Remember, Goliath is this massive man. Saul, although he was strong and powerful, he was not nearly as strong and powerful as Goliath. But he grabbed them out of his hands in this shocking Goliath and ran off before anybody could do anything with him and saved the tablets. There you have an example of Ze'ev Yitruf, the snatching wolf. That is that is an example of Binyamin. That's a clear example of it happening. But it happens also in a less dramatic way. What happens when Mordechai and Esther defeat Haman? What happens over there? Haman is triumphant. Haman is ready to finally destroy the Jewish people. He's at the very pinnacle of his greatness. He's second only to the king, and he's being invited to a feast to the king and queen. The queen invited only the king and him to this feast. He's at the top. Nothing could hurt him now. And at that very moment when he's reaching the pinnacle of his success, it is snatched out right out from under him. Mordechai and Esther snatch away his glory at that moment, and they turn it on his head. They don't come with axes or swords and power. It's not the Yehuda way of doing things, Yehuda with his army, with his might. Or remember God, who's able to, in one fell swoop, he's able to sever the arm and head of the enemy. Remember the powerful tribes. Binyamin doesn't do it that way. But he also doesn't do it in Dunn's way, where Dunn kind of sneaks up on the person and inflicts tremendous damage with a guerrilla attack. That's not the way Binyamin does it either. Binyamin is a different way altogether. Binyamin snatches. It's not with this powerful army, it's not with this powerful attack, a frontal attack, it's not like that, but it's also not with this sneakiness that Dunn uses, but rather it's with this very quick, very agile, very alert snatch. That's what Binyamin is able to do. And Shaul demonstrates it when he snatches away the tablets. Mordechai and Esther demonstrate it dramatic. Okay, but it is dramatic, but it's not as, you don't see it, it's more conceptual. Right. It's more subtle. Right. Where they snatch it away, they snatch away victory right out from under Haman's feet. And they take it instead. That is the way Binyamin is able to. Binyamin is able to turn the tables suddenly. The sudden, dramatic snatch, grab, swipe. That's Binyamin Ze'ev Yitruf. That's what he represents. That is why Binyamin is the one who is destined to defeat Amalek. Amalek, Haman is from Amalek. We always find, I've talked about this before, how Binyamin is the one, the antagonist against Haman, against Amalek, that Binyamin, with his sudden, swift move, is the one who will eventually defeat Amalek. Amalek, who thrives on getting the Jews to be uncertain, to have suffix, to have doubt. We know that Amalek attacks when the Jews say, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu im'ayin, is Hashem in our midst or not? When the Jews begin to doubt themselves and aren't clear about their mission, that's when Amalek is most powerful, is able to attack the Jewish people. Binyamin is the one who is able to swiftly, suddenly, with just a very quick move, turn the tables. Everything gets turned upside down against Amalek. That's Binyamin's power. And that is the final one, the final tribe. And now, this will leave this for next time already, starting with Chavkasa 28, we're going to move into the summing up of all of the blessings, and finally Yaakov's last words before he does pass away. And we'll talk about this Mirz Hashem next time.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.